Good morning. My name's Katrina, and I'm going to be reading the Bible for us this morning. Today's passage is from John chapter 18, starting at verse 28, and can be found on page 755 of the Pew Bibles. Then the Jewish leaders took Jesus from Caiaphas to the palace of the Roman governor. By now, it was early morning, and to avoid ceremonial uncleanness, they did not enter the palace because they wanted to be able to eat the Passover. So Pilate came out to them and asked, "What charges are you bringing against this man?" "If he were not a criminal," they replied, "we would not have handed him over to you." Pilate said, "Take him yourselves and judge him by your own law." "But we have no right to execute anyone," they objected. This took place to fulfill what Jesus had said about the kind of death he was going to die. Pilate then went back inside the palace, summoned Jesus, and asked him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" "Is that your own idea?" Jesus asked. "Or did others talk to you about me?" "Am I a Jew?" Pilate replied. "Your own people and chief priests handed you over to me. What is it you have done?" Jesus said, "My kingdom is not of this world. If it were, my servants would fight to prevent my arrest by the Jewish leaders. But now my kingdom is from another place." "You are a king then," said Pilate. Jesus answered, "You say that I am a king. In fact, the reason I was born and came into the world is to testify to the truth. Everyone on the side of truth listens to me." "What is truth?" retorted Pilate. With this, he went out again to the Jews gathered there and said, "I find no basis for a charge against him. But it is your custom for me to release to you one prisoner at the time of the Passover. Do you want me to release the king of the Jews?" They shouted back, "No, not him. Give us Barabbas." Now Barabbas had taken part in an uprising.
Thanks so much. Well, hey, my name's Tom. If I haven't met you before, I would love to do that after we are done in here. Every week, you might feel kind of new. There are lots of new people sitting around you, and that's an exciting thing to be a part of. Let's begin going through today's passage by starting at the end. Those last couple of verses that we just had read for us give this incredible swap between the guilty prisoner and the innocent one. If we can pull up verse 38 on the screen, it says this: "With this, he went out again to the Jews gathered there, and he said, 'I find no basis for a charge against him. But it's your custom for me to release to you one prisoner at the time of the Passover. Do you want me to release the king of the Jews?'" Now, a little bit of background that will make sense of this interaction here. At that time, Jerusalem was a militarily occupied city. The military occupiers were the Romans and the locals were the Jews. And at the significant calendar moment in the local calendar, the Passovers, the Roman military occupants would give a show of goodwill and they would release a prisoner that they had taken from the locals back to them. People knew he was about to do this. It seems like he'd been doing it for multiple years in a row. And so why is there a crowd gathered at Pilate's place? It's because they've come to ask for the release of their local hero, Barabbas. They love Barabbas because he took part in an uprising, verse 40. Barabbas did exactly what lots of people were hoping Jesus would do. In fact, last week, Jared preached for us. It was excellent. He talked about how Peter might actually have just been a shattered man, not just a straightforward coward, particularly because he was hoping for this kind of military overthrow. That's why he pulls out his sword in the garden, chops the guy's ear off. He hadn't quite got it yet. And the crowd who are gathered there are just like Peter. What they really want, top of mind, is somebody from among them to form an uprising, to lead a revolt against their Roman oppressors. And Barabbas had a crack. Barabbas actually showed some guts, unlike this Jesus guy, who's the alternative released prisoner.
And so they've showed up, not because they want to ask for an evil man, as much as he might have done some evil things, but they've shown up because they want their local hero back. That's the essence of the exchange that's being proposed to them. And yet, below that, there's an interesting layer to what's happening, and it has to do with Barabbas's name. If you're kind of new to the things of church, don't worry about this. But if you've been hanging out here for a long time, you might have heard the word Abba. And Abba means father. It's right there in the middle of Barabbas's name. That B-A-R at the front probably means something like son. So his name is son of the father, son of a father, which is fascinating when you contrast it with who Jesus truly is, the father's son. The choice that they're being offered is, do you want me to release to you today, son of a father? And they say, we want you to crucify the father's son. This is actually the very essence of the gospel, by the way. So if you are still latching on to how the whole Christian thing works, the Christian thing is not, you must be an excellent person and then God will love you. It's not just seven steps to make your year a little bit better. The Christian faith, in essence, is that there are guilty people and there was once one innocent man. This is being played out in micro for us with Barabbas and Jesus. If we're like anyone in this passage, we're like Barabbas. Because in God's sight, we actually are guilty. And yet there is one innocent man, that's Jesus. And the essence of the Christian faith is that we put our allegiance with Jesus, we trust in him, and when he went to the cross in our place for our sins as our substitute, it means that all the Barabbases, all of us, can go free. It's a beautiful moment of the gospel shining through. Let's go back to the start of the passage. John chapter 18. My plan for today is to walk us through just verse by verse, sitting under the scriptures, letting them inform our understanding of the way the world works. So when we come to John chapter 18, verse 28, which is where we started, there's a little bit of background to that. What's been happening so far is that in John chapter 12, Jesus has entered into Jerusalem riding on a donkey. There's great fanfare. People are thinking, maybe this guy's going to come and overthrow the Romans. This will be great. But when you read John 13 through 17, that's the upper room discourse or his last chat with his disciples, you realize he's got some very different things on his agenda from military occupancy. He's thinking about what he wants his people to be getting on with between his resurrection and his return, which is the same age in which we live right now. Now, in John chapter 18, he knows that Judas has gone to the garden to guide that detachment of soldiers. He goes there on purpose. And as a result of being arrested, they take him to two different types of authority in the flow of the way John recounts it. Firstly, they take him to the religious authorities. This all happens overnight, which is symbolic of the nature of what's going on. It's a dark set of events. And having been judged guilty by the religious authorities, they take him to the military Roman authority. And that's what's happening in our passage here today. If you missed the story, what happens is eventually he ends up getting crucified. That's where we're going on the way to Easter. So John chapter 18, verse 28. Let's start verse by verse. Then the Jewish leaders took Jesus from Caiaphas to the palace of the Roman governor. By now it was early morning, and to avoid ceremonial uncleanness, they did not enter the palace because they wanted to be able to eat the Passover. If you've been in a growth group, which is where we get together midweek to discuss the Bible, go really deep on it, it's very likely that somebody asked the question, why can't they go into the palace? How would that stop them eating the Passover? Now, the short answer to that question is it's pretty hard to identify one Old Testament verse that says you can't go into a Roman palace if you want to eat the Passover. But the functional understanding at the time seemed to be that people considered the Gentiles or the non-local, the non-Jewish people to be some kind of ceremonially unclean. And going into their house was exceptionally unclean. And so if you were a religious authority, you're really looking forward to the religious festival of the Passover, and you're pretty keen to say ceremonially unclean. You are really concerned to eat the Passover. And here is the incredible irony of the whole thing. The Passover was first in Exodus was when it actually happened, and then the people had been celebrating it for many, many years since then. God's people were slaves to the Egyptians. God says, I'm going to make death pass throughout the whole land, and then you're going to leave. But here's what I want you to do. I want you to slaughter an animal. It's a bit gross. Put the blood on your doorpost, and death will not come into your house. Death will pass over your house. Here's the magic. 1 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 7. Paul identifies Jesus as our Passover lamb. Jesus is the fulfillment of the very festival that they were so concerned to take part in. They were so keen to take part in the Passover, and yet they totally missed the Passover lamb who was right in front of them. We don't physically do this, but symbolically, you paint the blood of Jesus on your doorpost, and God's judgment passes over you. Jesus is our true Passover lamb. Have a look at verse 30 with me. We'll roll through this passage until we come to a discussion of truth. So Pilate came out to them. Should we start at 29? So Pilate came out to them and asked, what charges are you bringing against this man? Remember, it's early morning, so it's very possible he hasn't had his coffee yet. Verse 30, if he were not a criminal, they replied, we would not have handed him over to you. Bit cryptic. Pilate says, verse 31, well, take him yourselves, judge him by your own law. But we have no right to execute anyone, they said. So this is what they want. They want Jesus executed. And in this moment, Pilate realizes, oh, gee, like he must have done something that has really upset you. This has leveled up in his estimation. Verse 32. This took place to fulfill what Jesus had said about the kind of death he was going to die. Now, same thing in your growth group this week. Somebody might have asked, what was the prophecy that Jesus is fulfilling here? Can I take you into the cheat notes? So all the growth group leaders get cheat notes each week. And the cheat notes said he's fulfilling Matthew chapter 20, particularly verses 18 and 19. Let me read that to you. We are going up to Jerusalem. The Son of Man will be delivered over to the chief priests and teachers of the law. They'll condemn him to death and will hand him over to the Gentiles to be mocked and flogged and crucified. On the third day, he'll be raised to life. The key aspect of what Jesus is fulfilling, if you think Matthew is the verse in mind, is that he's being handed over from his people, the Jews, to the Gentiles. And Jesus predicted this. If you wanted to stay more tightly within the language of John and you say, hey, which bit of John has Jesus fulfilled here? It's probably got something to do with less being handed over to the Gentiles and more the type of death that he dies. So John chapter 3, verse 14, and it happens again in John 12. He says this, just as Moses lifted up the snake in the wilderness, so the Son of Man must be lifted up. He's talking about the type of death that he's going to die, which is one that can only be done by the Romans. He's talking about crucifixion. Here's how crucifixion works. You get the guy you want to crucify, you put two pieces of wood on the ground. You put the guy on the ground on the piece of wood, you attach the guy to the piece of wood, and then somebody stands behind, or they get some ropes and they stand in front, and they hoik the thing up. The base falls into a little hole that you've pre-cut in the ground. You lift up the guy who you would like to expose to public shame and ultimately to kill. And either way, whether you think Jesus is fulfilling Matthew, handed over to the Gentiles, or you think he's fulfilling John, being lifted up, either way, it's kind of the same amazing truth, which is that Jesus is in control of his own death. This is not things getting a little bit out of hand and Jesus trying to bring them back into control. This was the Father's plan all along. This is Jesus' willing participation all along. And so, verse 33, Pilate then went back inside the palace, summoned Jesus and asked him, are you the king of the Jews? Verse 34, is that your own idea, Jesus asked, or did others talk about me? 35, am I a Jew? Pilate replied. He's kind of scorning because he would consider his empire to be superior to other people groups. Your own people and chief priests handed you over to me. What is it you've done? Now, Jesus says, my kingdom is not of this world. So he is answering the question from a couple of verses ago, but very cryptically. If it were, my servants would fight to prevent my arrest by the Jewish leaders, but now my kingdom is from another place. This goes a little way to explain why did he tell Peter to put the sword back in when he pulled it out in the garden. He says, my kingdom is not from this place. He's saying, hey, Pilate, I'm no military threat to you, mate. I'm on something completely different. Pilate, though, latches onto the king language, verse 37. He says, you are a king then, in which case I better do something about that because there can be no opposition to Caesar's rule. Jesus answered, well, you say that I'm a king. In fact, the reason I was born and came into the world is to testify to the truth. Now get this statement. Everyone on the side of truth listens to me. I wonder how you feel about that statement. Everyone on the side of truth listens to me. I feel a little bit awkward about it. I feel a little bit uncomfortable inside. Kind of anybody saying, I am the side of truth. I am always right. I am never wrong. Everyone on the other side is silly. I'm like, oh, this is not quite how people, you know, generally talk in my orbit. I feel really uncomfortable even about Jesus claiming everyone on the side of truth listens to me. If you've dwelt in the Western secular mind, if this is the way you've been taught to think, I imagine you also have a little bit of discomfort with his absolutism, with his objectivism, with his strength of his claim. And can we do a little bit of shared self-awareness? Can we do a self-awareness exercise today? Why do we feel that way? Why am I so uncomfortable with anyone claiming an association with truth? Because not everyone around the world has that same discomfort. Not everyone throughout history feels this way about that kind of statement. What is it about the water in which I swim which has made me this way? Now, I listened to a sermon from a well-known American preacher called Tim Keller. He pointed out some French philosophy. Do you want to do some philosophy with me? This is Michel Foucault, and he said that I am more influenced by this guy than I realize. Michel Foucault said this. Great screenshot, by the way. Lovely picture. Truth is a thing of this world. It's produced only by multiple forms of constraint, and that includes the regular effects of power. To put that in other words, truth is a power claim. You're trying to get power over me when you say that you have the truth. There's something in it for you. If I accept your truth claim, you gain, and I'm just a puppet in your pursuit of power. Now, Michel Foucault wasn't operating in a bubble. He was probably influenced by German philosophy. We're going all over today. This is Friedrich Nietzsche. This is an even better screenshot. I love this one. And he introduced the idea, or he really majored on the idea of hermeneutics of suspicion, which means I'm skeptical about your truth claim. You make a truth claim, I'm going to squint a little bit and say, why are you saying that? What's in it for you? Why do you want me to believe your narrative of what's going on here? And here's the thing, you and I, whether or not we realize it, have probably been influenced by this kind of thinking more than we knew. Often in philosophy, at the time the idea is proposed or the book is written, it's a little bit out there. After a generation or two, it becomes an option. And maybe 100 years, maybe more later, sometimes these ideas work their way into the fabric of certain societies, not globally, but specifically for us here today, these ones. And they just become part of the thought system, even without our awareness of it. And so we, if you're anything like me, I'm really uncomfortable with the idea of truth claims. I'm really skeptical about anyone making them. And if you're in that kind of boat with me as well, I think what Pilate says next is also fascinating because he goes, what is truth? And he's probably asking it less like a first year walking around a university thinking these big thoughts for the first time, And he's more post-truth. He's more jaded. He's more over the whole thing because he's probably a politically savvy operator in order to get this posting from Rome to go and run Jerusalem. He was probably quite used to adjusting the truth or highlighting some aspects of it, downplaying other aspects of it, presenting things in the right way at the right time to the right people. He knew that truth was really, it's all about who's in charge, who's got the most weapons, who's the king, who's got power and truth, not really that important of a category. Now, against that background, and we are moving towards a close, I'd love to raise two fascinating things that Jesus has said about his relation to truth already in the gospel of John. John chapter 8, have a look at this. John chapter 8, verse 32, he says something that to us is so counterintuitive, but deeply helpful. John 8:32, he says, "The truth will set you free." Full quote, "If you hold to my teaching, you are really my disciples. Then you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free." For many of us, truth and freedom feel like they are in opposite categories. You know, don't put your truth on me. I just want to live my free version of life. And yet, at the same time, we do know that in some instances, adhering to the way things really are does lead to freedom, right? I'll give you a silly example and a serious example. The silly example is that you're going somewhere you've never been before in your car. You've got your phone on the dash and you've got your Google Maps or your Waze or whatever. And it says, go right. It's the fastest way to get there. And you say, don't put your truth claims on me. You're not expressing power over me, Silicon Valley, trying to take over my world. I'm going left. You're just going to have a bad time. You know, it's not going to make your life any better. Actually, just adhering to the way the geography of this city works will make your life a bit better. Serious example, medicine. I am very interested that the medicine that I take is researched, is grounded in the reality of how physiology works, that somebody who's put this all together has a deep understanding of chemistry and all of this. I'm very interested that they're not trying to kind of use me for my money. What I'm after is the fact that they have actually gone through the rigorous process of testing this thing, that this medicine I hold in my hand will actually have the power to free me from what's wrong with my body. I want truth. And false medicine isn't going to lead me to freedom. I want true medicine that's actually grounded in reality. Can I take you to the second thing that Jesus said about truth? John chapter 14. If you've been around church for a little while, this might be familiar. If you're kind of new, by the way, this is a fascinating statement to wrestle with. John 14:6. Jesus answered, "I am the way, the truth, and the life." Notice Pilate's question. He said, what is truth? Jesus is talking in a different category. He's asking, who is truth? And I think, to be honest, we are right to be skeptical about truth claims. There are so many competing angles on things, and with our increased exposure, just the internet and all that, we're able to access all the different things that people might say about something. We are right to be skeptical about truth claims. And in the same moment, we have to follow some truth. Truth still matters. And what we're trying to do here is not say all truth is wrong, but we have to say, who am I going to listen to? Who am I going to grant the position of truth teller in my world to? Who do I trust? Who is my faith in? Who do I believe? Because there are many unhelpful people to believe. And here's the thing. You think about your criteria for that decision. Who do I trust? And part of it is that I just want to trust somebody who actually knows what they're talking about and has power and is also kind. I just want to trust someone who has a good grasp on reality and also has my best interests at heart. And if there is anyone who has ever made truth claims, who comes close to fitting that set of criteria, isn't it the one who, just a couple of chapters earlier, is literally washing people's feet? Like, he washed the feet of the guy who was about to betray him. And I say, I think I could possibly trust that guy. You look at what happens after this chapter, and he goes to the cross, and I say, I don't think he's putting any kind of power or authority on me in that moment. I think he's just dying for my good. He's the innocent one going free so that the guilty party, me, I don't think Jesus is gaining from this interaction where they lift him up on the cross and he ends up dying in the hot Middle Eastern sun. I think if there's anyone who I could ever conceive of giving the position of truth teller to in my life, it would be the guy who rose again from the dead to show that he actually knows what's going on and he actually has power in this world. And he also seems to be kind. He also seems to be good. He also seems to have our best interests at heart. We're going to sing about some of that stuff now. Band, do you want to come up? And if you'd like to pray with me, let's join together. God, we live in a world that's actually very confusing often with so many truth claims. We ask that you'd help us to stick close to your truth. We ask that our kids would grow up to be people who acknowledge and love your truth. We ask that in areas of our life where we have strayed from your truth, that you would forgive us and bring us back to it. God, we ask that we would ultimately be truth people, and we worship you as someone who is actually good, powerful, and also kind. And everyone who agreed said,